Okay, so today, well, at least I have faces to, I know where to look. So today I continue the introduction to non-abelian gauge series by discussing quantization and gauge fixing. So quantization and gauge fixing. Fixing the gauge is required for the same reason that in Maxwell theory and quantum electrodynamics, but the non-abelian case has some specific and very interesting feature. So I remember that, hello, we start from a gauge theory based on a non-abelian group. Well, typically I'm using SU2. So SU2 has three generators because it's a three-dimensional real group. And so it has three generators TA, which are one half of the Pauli matrices. So A, 1, 2, 3. For SU3, it would be 8. And we have three gauge fields. We have vector bosons with some charge, some symmetry charges, and not no charge like in the U1 theory. And so that depends on space-time, of course, as vector potential in Maxwell theory. And it's convenient to regroup them into a multiplet, which is an element of the Lie algebra of SU2. So this is a generator of the Lie algebra. Little SU2, which is a Lie algebra, which is the algebra of Hermitian and traceless matrices. So I'm going often to use the compact notation, A mu equal A mu A TA, that's very convenient. And in order to have a quantum theory, one requires one needs gauge invariance for in order to preserve unitarity. And therefore, the theory is invariant under gauge transformation, local gauge transformation, which in the case of the SU in the non-abelian gauge theory are different from more complicated than from abelian, because the variation of A mu goes to A mu plus d mu alpha minus, and not to make any mistakes, minus I the commutator of A mu with the generator of the gauge transformation, where this is alpha. It's just a notation for denoting alpha A T A. Those are the generators. Infinitesimal generators of the gauge transformation on the electromagnetic on the gauge field. Okay, and so this is new with respect to the with respect to U1, because it's a commutator of two matrices, and it's going to involve the, if you write it in terms of component A and alpha B, say, it involves the structure constant of the Lie algebra, which are basically that denoted by T when you compute the commutator of two generators. This is F A, B, C, T, C, T, B, T, C. Yeah. Good for SU2 are just the anti-symmetric tensor. Okay, and what's important is the fact that you have the covariant derivative. Yes?
Sorry, it's rather like F A B C T C. No.
I'm sorry. Yes, that's C.
Like
you consider the you consider two generators. It's F. Let's call it B. It's F A B C T C. Yes, sorry. Yes. So, that's it.
TA,
I'm sorry. Okay. Yes, it's just that this is an element algebra, so you decompose it into the exponent, and this is a structure constant. Thank you. Okay. And you have to consider the covariant derivative, d mu, which for a field in the adjoint representation, like the electromagnetic field, is d mu of something in the adjoint representation. It's just the ordinary derivative with respect to space-time, minus I, the commutator of A mu with the field which belongs in the adjoint representation. Okay, which is covariant under those gauge transformations. Okay, so now we have seen that, from that we have an action, and the action is obtained from the stress for the electromagnetic tensor, so the which is F mu nu, which is commutator and D mu and E nu, so it's an antithematic tensor, and it's D mu A nu minus D nu A mu plus, and I'm going to make a mistake if I don't write my notes. There is this commutator, chop, minus I, the commutator of A mu and A nu. So this is nu with respect to electromagnetism. And the action is S of A equal 1 over 2 g squared, that's a coupling constant, integral over space-time of the trace of F mu nu squared. That's a bit mixing with that. There is a minus sign in Minkowski space, and if you walk out in Euclidean space, there is a plus sign. So you see that for in Euclidean, that's this one. So this is square, this is positive. So the action has a minimum. Okay. Okay. And I take the trace because F mu nu is a 2x2 antisymmetric matrix. So you make a product of those two, and you take the trace, using the fact, of course, that, which is important, that trace of TA, TB is normalized to be 1/2 delta AB, Dirac, Kronecker symbol. Okay, and this action is invariant, is gauge invariant.
That's why we have the trace.
You need the trace in order, of course, to be gauge invariant, because otherwise you have to choose. This is a 2x2 matrix. So making the trace makes you sum over all the group indices when you write this in terms of component, which is a bit more complicated. So that is something which is just a simple scalar, a number. Okay. And you can check easily that F mu nu is a transformed covariantly. So you see, the A mu doesn't transform covariantly because of this term. Right, but F mu nu is a gauge, let's say, covariant quantity under a gauge transformation. F mu transform according to this relation with no d mu alpha. That's what the covariant derivative is made for. Okay. Okay, so this action is gauge invariant. Exactly like for the electromagnetism or Maxwell's theory, where this is just, you have no trace because each F mu is a 1x1 matrix, so it's just a single number. Okay, so now, why do we need gauge fixing? Well, we need gauge fixing for the exactly the same reason that in Maxwell's theory. That's because, in fact, A mu doesn't is not unique, doesn't uniquely define. Well, you have not a single AMU associated to each F mu nu, which contains the electromagnetic fields, which are the physical quantity that you can observe when you're making measurement in your theory. Therefore, AMU is a redundant information. So you have several AMU, which by equivalent by gauge transformation, which gives the same electromagnetic tensor. And for this reason, now if you want to quantize, naively by pass integral, you want to define something like dA, exponential of I S of A. This is a gauge action here. That's naive way to write this in functional integral. And that's, it makes perfectly sense because you just write that this measure is just the product of all these indices of AMU A of X, or this is something like formally products over X, products over A and mu, and a measure on D AMU A of X. And you can check that this measure is gauge invariant as the action, gauge invariant. But when you want to study this, you see you have flat direction in this direction. So if you make a gauge transformation on A, any local gauge transformation, the action doesn't change. So using a path integral to make perturbation theory won't work because they are going flat direction where the action doesn't change. And therefore, when you try to invert the second derivative of the action, you cannot because it has flat direction. So if some of its eigenvalue are zero, so you cannot invert that. So gauge fixing. Just needed in order to remove the flat directions. And removing the flat direction is not something which is some fancy mathematical trick. It's just because, you know, different AMU correspond to exactly the same physical configuration. So you can count them only once without changing the without making sense of the physics. Okay, so now I will just draw a picture, which is in the lecture notes, which is basically explains what you when you want to quantize, you are summing over all gauge field configuration. So imagine that, make this picture here, imagine that you have some the big space of all field configurations. So it's a field of function. Yes?
Just one question. When you say flat, are you saying flat because of the analogy to like curvature?
No. I mean flat. That means that the variation of the action is zero. So it's a flat in the sense that this is a potential. Yeah. I'm going to come back to this. So it has nothing to do with the space of gauge fields or gauge, because gauge field are gauge connection. So the space of configuration with a proper metric is a curved space because the SU2 group is not an abelian group. Mm-hmm. So in some sense, the fact that it has commutator means that it has some intrinsic curvature. Okay. So imagine that you have your big space here, which is a space of all A. By A, I mean A mu A of X. So let me call this big space curly A. Okay. And now, so a point in this space is just a configuration of A. Okay. And a point is A configuration. Okay. But many configuration of gauge field correspond to the same physical configuration, because by changing A into AG, which is just with G an element of the gauge group. So an element of the gauge group means simply that G is a compact way to describe a collection of G of X for all the points with G belonging to SU2. So this is the big gauge group. Okay, so we can describe this big gauge group by a capital G. Okay, and making a gauge transformation on G means, well, it means just like integrating this kind of transformation. So it means that you change A by macroscopic configuration. So you write, so this is just this form when G is just the identity times exponential I alpha. So that's the relation between the Lie algebra of the group and the element of the group. Okay. And well, I have it somewhere, but basically, you see that when you apply a gauge transformation on A, you get a different question. Yes. Yeah.
I had a question in. Means when we write the big G, there we are, means it's like at every point in space-time, we are having an SU2 group and each SU2 element.
Yes, exactly. Yes, that's the meaning of having a local gauge invariance. It means that you are free to perform a gauge transformation on the field, which is different than each point of space-time. Well, it has to be continuous if you want to have a derivative. But somehow you have a smooth function from space-time on the group, but it can be any smooth function. And from that, you apply this to A and you get AG.
Okay, I see.
Okay. And basically, the relation is basically simple. This means that AG is, I think, G minus 1, B mu of A. No, that's something simpler. Well, I have the formula somewhere. I just don't find it. I'm afraid to make a mistake, but okay, I will write it a bit later. Okay, so basically you start from a given A here. And if you make a gauge transformation by different Gs, you get different field configuration, which describes the same physical field. The same F mu nu, well, up to a matrix transformation, because it's a matrix. Okay, so you have what we can call, well, I had yes. Let me take this. So you have here an orbit of the gauge configuration. And so the gauge group acts on the space of all gauge field. That's a mathematical language. And this is given a given A here. You have the orbit of A by the action of the gauge group. So all points on this space, this is a 2x2 definition, but in fact, it's a very big functional space. So this is a surface in this big functional space. Each point describes the same physical configuration. Now, of course, you may have a different gauge field configuration, which correspond to different physical configuration of the gauge field. And if they are different, if they have different orbits. You see, so you have a prime, et cetera, et cetera. So the space of physical configuration of the electromagnetic field physically is just the space of orbits. So physical configuration equal orbits of A under the action of G. Okay, so that's what mathematicians called the quotient of a space by the group on which acts on A. Yes?
A little side question. Is this the motivation for writing the action of G like as a right action?
As a?
Like G acting as a right on A?
Okay, no, so, well, that's a representation, but well, I have to. I just am a bit confused, but the action, the definition, it's just a definition that comes from this. So in fact, well, I should. I'm very sorry. Suddenly, I know the. Okay, so here it is. So local gauge transformation of A.
Action of G on
means yeah. So a gauge transformation for A for a big J is just the formula are in my notes. I'm just sorry not to remember it by heart. So a gauge transformation is you change A mu into G mu minus well plus pi mu minus one. That's the formula. The system wouldn't be there for a field gauge covariant. But A mu is not gauge covariant, so there is this additional thing. So remember, this is an SU2 matrix, a unitary matrix. This is a 2x2 Hermitian traces matrix. This is an SU2 matrix that you can define by under this transformation, where now G is a function of X, and this is the inverse of the matrix E, which is unitary, you get still a traceless Hermitian matrix. So this is a global gauge transformation. We can, well. Okay, so let's come back to this picture. So you have this set of orbits. And basically, what one is interested is to, in a path integral, is to sum over all different classical configurations of the gauge field. So what we need is to pick a representative in each orbit. So that, fortunately, well, if we choose a right representative, there is only one in each orbit. So doing this is just what is called in physics fixing a gauge. So fixing a gauge means choose a representative A in each orbit. And we can choose this by a gauge fixing condition. So basically, you choose a you choose one each orbit, so you are restricting this to a space of a gauge fixing slice. This is going by gauge fixing. And it's enough to sum over all gauge field configuration instead of any of them. Yes?
So it feels like there's like this is one of two options we can do. The other thing you can imagine is just integrating over the whole space and then dividing by sort of volume.
No, that's equivalent. Well, yeah, no, that's equivalent. We know that we can integrate over all space. That's a naive way. That's but it's perfectly consistent, and that's what is done, for instance, when people do numerical calculation using lattice gauge theory by computer. But in order to do perturbation theory, that's more complicated, so one has to devise a way to do that. But the two are going to be equivalent. Okay, so I prefer to view this as fixing a slice, but then, so basically, well, you can choose as gauge. Well, the most used gauge in gauge theories is called the Landau gauge. It's called the Landau gauge. This is it, that d mu a mu a at any point x is zero. But of course, in electromagnetism, you have other gauges which are used. You have the Coulomb gauge, the axial gauge, etc. But I will restrict to that. So this is a Landau gauge. Is one way to fix, to choose a representative. So yes.
You know that. Is it like if you see me geometrically, you have like a set of lines, and you want to pick a line that intersects its line just once.
Yes.
And exactly once.
Yes.
How are you so sure that that condition, because this is a kind of complicated manifold, will just intersect its orbit once and only once?
Well, it's a good question because we aren't sure. And in fact, for non-abelian gauge series, this condition speaks a single configuration only if you are in the vicinity of pure gauge. So in the vicinity of the point where A equals zero, for instance. So, only one. That's not always possible. But when one does perturbation theory, one is going to study what are the effect of the small a, which are, you know, small changes with respect to A equals zero, the vacuum, the classical vacuum of the theory. So it's not a problem, but it can be. Non-perturbative issue. And in fact, it is in general. It's called the Grieboff problem. And that's known in non-abelian gauge series since the 70s. Okay, but I won't consider that because it's a non-perturbative issue. But it's an important one. Okay, so let's keep the Landau gauge here. And basically, I'm going to use a very compact notation by, so you have one gauge condition for each point of space and for each component of the gauge field. So I'm going to write this as just the gauge fixing. I'm just going to denote it in a very compact way by a functional f of a, which is local, namely it depends on a and the derivative of a, and it's some function. So in my case, f of a is just d mu of a mu, and of course, f of a is a collection of f a for each point of space-time. But I denote in the same way that I denote all field configuration by just a capital A. Here you have, I denote by F of A, the set of all local gauge fixing condition and all the component for A equal 1, 2, 3. Just a compact notation. So you notice that the gauge fixing condition, it depends on x, it depends on a, but it doesn't depend on the direction space-time because there are no mu indices because you do sum, you take here the divergence of a. Okay, so you have as many gauge conditions as you have point in space-time and direction on your group. Okay. Okay. And now, so naively, doing gate cyclic condition means that instead of writing a functional integral over all configuration with an exponential of I times the action, the gauge action that I wrote, you impose that f of a is zero. So I am writing this as a Dirac delta function over the space of each configuration of Dirac of each f of a. So I take for lambda gauge f of a, this is f of a. A of x. And you know, fixing a gate condition, putting a delta function of f of a. So this seems to do the job, because then you make just a functional integral over this gauge fixing slice. But one has to be careful, because if you do that, this measure is not gauge invariant in the following sense. You see, you have an orbit. So to each point on the orbit, if you make a small deformation by the same gauge parameter, here this is a basic element of under a delta g, you move by this amount on the gauge orbit. Here you move by some object, here you move, and you see. And it's unclear, in general, it's not the case that the volume element is the same everywhere. So you should not take as volume element, well, the naive Mellin element delta of f of a, but you must add something which counteracts this, so that you need that the basic volume element is the one associated to gauge transformation. We need this to be gauge invariant.
What element is this exactly? Because it's not in space-time, but in this larger space.
Well, this is a picture. This is just a schematic in two dimensions, so that's very naive, of something which happens in some very big and, in fact, in general, infinite dimensional space. But you get the picture. And you need to have to associate the right measure to each point on the gauge fixed slice. And doing this doesn't do the job. OK?
So this is a slice in real space, or in this?
No. So here I am integrating over this gauge fixing slice. You see, because this is the slice where f of a is zero. But on the slice f of a equals zero, which is you enforce by this delta function, which enforce that everywhere d mu a mu is zero, for instance, for the gauge, for the Landau gauge, you need to know what is the measure induced by the gauge invariant measure on the whole space here, which still is compatible with gauge invariance. Okay, so I'm going to show you which is the correct measure on the gauge fixing slice that you have to use. And I'm going first to give you the result, which is the famous, which is due to Fadeyev and Popov, and also to Rice-DeWitt and to Feynman. Its most famous formulation is due to those two famous Russian mathematicians and theoretical physicists. Which is the measure term here, which keeps consistency with gauge invariance. Okay, well, in order to do that, let me just give a simple example of in one dimension. Imagine that you have a function in one dimension, let's call it the variable x. Well, it's not the same as x, so let's call it a. Well, y, let's say. Okay, and I have a function f y, it's a real function, and I want to pick up the point where f of y equals zero. I want to pick up it with just a measure one. So I want to write, of course, that one is integral over dy, delta of y minus y zero, when y zero here is a point such that f of y zero equals zero, is a function f. Okay? And we assume that there is only such a point. So for instance, that the function f is a increasing function. So there's only one point y zero when the function f is equal to zero. Of course, enforcing that f of y equals zero can be done by integral dy delta of f of y, where delta is a Dirac delta function now on the function f. So delta is a Dirac measure along this axis. But I want the Dirac measure along this axis. Well, there is a very famous identity which states that the Dirac delta function at y0 is a Dirac delta function of f of y multiplied by the derivative of y. So in order to compensate from this measure to this measure, you have to multiply by the slope of the function at the point where it vanishes. Oh. Of the function f. You see? And with this correcting factor, you get the correct measure, which picks up with just weight one, the function, the point y0 where the function f vanishes. Well, for this more general infinite dimensional problem, where you integrate over an infinite number of variables, which are the a, mu, a, x, it turns out that you get exactly the same factor, the same kind of factor, but now since it's in differential forms, what you need is to pick up, instead of a derivative, the determinant of the Jacobian matrix. So we get here the determinant of the Jacobian matrix under the coordinates, under the orbits, which are elements of the gauge group. Yes?
How do we get that? Means I don't see the equality. I mean, one equals dy delta y minus y, but then how is that equal to the other dy delta of f of y?
Well, that's an elementary property of, because you see, this is just Jacobian of the change of variable df.
Okay.
You see, it's just a formula. It's just the formula of what's the variation of a function is the variation of the of its argument times the derivative of the function. It's nothing but that.
Okay. So I mean, this quantity on the right is like df and delta f of y. Oh, I see.
Yeah. So let me go on. Here, you are going to write something which is the determinant of the derivative of the gauge function. So I'm going to write this f prime of a. And so you are going to give the determinant of some big matrix, which is partial derivatives. Derivatives of the gauge fixing condition under local gauge transformations. Local gauge transformation moves you along the orbits. So this is a very compact way to write this. And I'm going to explain what this complicated object is. But basically, you have to understand it as a determinant of some big, big matrix. Yeah.
We were also just wondering, when you gave this example of the Landau gauge, is the key of this example suddenly equal to zero?
Yes.
Okay. So.
But this can be defined even when f of a is non-zero. So this fixes f of a to be zero. And then you have the determinant in the same way that you see, f prime of y is defined everywhere on the real axis. And by the delta function, you pick up only the point where y is zero. But you could do the same thing by enforcing that f of y is f1, et cetera. So the formula works in general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah? So do we always have that f of a is W?
Yes.
That's
okay, so I'm going to explain what is this Fadeyev Popov, that's F, Fadeyev Popov determinant. Okay, so that's the following object. You consider the functional FA. Of x. And you make an infinitesimal gauge transformation. So you change a mu into a mu into a mu so minus d mu alpha minus I mu alpha. Okay. And you consider when I change A into A, denoted here by a gauge transformation. So I change A into AG with G equal 1 plus I delta alpha. So so I can write this as AG, of course, is A plus D alpha minus I A alpha, in very compact notation. Okay, and then I consider what is the variation of the gauge condition F of A when I change G into A into A1 plus I delta alpha. What is the variation to first order in delta alpha? And I derive by, I consider the partial derivative with respect to a point here. So you see, this is a function of A. That's a variation. So that's a variation. It's not the delta function. It's a variation. So this is something which depends on A and on X. And alpha depends on A and on Y. So this big matrix, which is a Jacobian matrix, is just a bilocal operator with respect to variation with, of course, the different indices, A and B. So it's a Jacobian matrix. And okay, in the case of the in the case of a Landau gauge, this is easy to compute because you see the gauge transformation of E mu is d mu. So I'm changing d mu of d mu of A mu A into d mu of A mu A plus basically, well, this is the covariant derivative which depend on A of alpha A. This is a covariant derivative of alpha. Okay. So the upper, the variation is just d mu of d mu of alpha, and you take the A component at point X of this object. This is a Jacobian. This is a variation of F. While the variation of alpha is just, well, this is the delta alpha, and so this is a, I'm making a variation, an infinitesimal variation. So this is a delta alpha. Okay, and here you get delta alpha at a point B of Y. So I'm considering the operator where I take d mu of delta alpha of X. So I first apply a covariant derivative to alpha, delta alpha, and then I apply an ordinary derivative. And now I pick the element alpha B of Y of this object. So what I get is that the what I get is that this big object, which is F prime of A. So this is an object which depends both on the variation of F prime of A. It depends on the point B, and it depends on the point X and Y, because I consider what is the effect on the variation of gauge transformation of Y at the gauge fixing term at point X. And since they are derivative, it's not going to be the same. And from this formula, what you find, this is just it's differential operator, d mu, and that's the matrix element BA of this, well, rather, it's a matrix element at point XY. So this is a matrix element. Element at point Y and X of this differential operator. Ordinary derivative applied to a covariant derivative on some of some field. And that's a bit abstract, but remember, d mu, well, I just erased it, but d mu is just d mu times an identity and minus I, the commutator of a mu is some function. So if you write it in terms of covariant derivative, No, I'm sorry. If you write it in terms of component, this is just the component of this obtained between the matrix element AB. This is just delta AB times d mu minus I times the component A of a commutator. So you are going to have a constant of the algebra. You are going to have epsilon AB, so if you want and that's you have d mu acting of this d mu, so you are going to have the d mu, and you have d mu here. So I have d mu, this is this first d mu, and this is the second d mu. You have two d mu, that's an ordinary operator. And then you have d mu acting on the commutator of A. But the commutator of A with something is just some f A, B, C, remember. So you get plus f A, well, the A is here, f A, B, C. D mu A A mu that's a C, I think. Okay, that comes from applying the first derivative on this A mu, and then you get plus F A B C A mu C D mu. That's when the D mu that you apply to this object right on this. Okay. So this is basically what is this the component of this of this differential operator, this A prime of A, A, B. So it's a differential operator, since it's a combination of derivation acting to the right of some function, it's a differential operator. But it contains a usual Laplacian, usual Laplace operator, or Klein-Gordon operator, which doesn't depend on the gauge field, and a new term which depends on the gauge field, A mu A, mu. It depends on the gauge field, and it's a first order term. You have a term which is just a multiplication by the divergence of the gauge field, and a term which is gauge field applied to the derivative of the function you apply this differential operator. So this object is a differential operator. It acts on function. It acts on function in the adjoint representation. And what you have to take is to consider is the determinant, the Fadeyev-Popov determinant of this differential operator, which depends on the gauge field. So you see this Fadeyev-Popov determinant, important formula is this one. This Fadeyev-Popov determinant depends on the gauge field. And if in the Maxwell theory, there is no commutator, so the Fadeyev-Popov determinant turns out to be there if you quantize properly gauge theories, but it's just an operator which doesn't depend on the gauge field. Okay, so I've been a bit sketchy because and the complete derivation, proper derivation, where you use your idea, your suggestion that you can integrate over the whole gauge field, will give exactly the same things times just a volume, an integration term, which is just the integration of the gauge field, which is independent of A. So if either you can either fix the gauge, you get this, if you want to get something consistent, or you do the integration by fix one representative, and then what comes out is the volume of the gauge field in front of the functional integral measure. But this volume of the gauge field is just a constant, so it doesn't play a role in the physics. Okay, so that's the important formula written here in a very compact way. This is a differential operator that we know. Yes?
What did you say about the determinant being independent of the gauge field?
No, I mean, this Fadeyev-Popov determinant, this differential operator here, depends on the gauge field because you have explicitly A here and A here.
Yeah.
You see? Except for an Abelian gauge theory, because it depends on the commutator, it's contained in the commutator. So this term vanishes.
Yeah, only for the Abelian case. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So this is a feature of gauge theory. So this is a feature of gauge non-Abelian theories. Okay, so I've been very sketchy, but I wanted you to get the idea behind this construction. And basically, that's a generalization of this very simple fact, that in order to have your proper measure when you pick up a point by the fact that it satisfies a constraint, here f of y equals zero, to get the correct measure on the integration space, you have to compensate the delta function by this derivative of the function. So this is basically the derivative, the functional derivative in the space of gauge transformation of the gauge fixing conditions. Okay? So that's the idea. And now if you work out, you just have to be a bit precise, you get this. This is a differential operator. If it acts on any function in the adjoint representation, it's the ordinary derivative minus the commutator of A with the function. And then you take the ordinary derivative of that, and this gives a non-trivial differential operator acting on the function, which is represented here by a dot. And this differential operator, you have to estimate the contribution of its determinant in the sense of the determinant of a functional differential operator acting on functions. Okay, and remember that we have seen already determinant of differential operator when we discussed gauge functional integration, and for instance, it gives you the one loop term of the effective action for a scalar field theory. Yes?
Sorry, just a quick question.
just make sure I understand. It's like the determinant with respect to A, B, and X, Y, right?
Well, it's a different xy means that because you see this is a differential operator. So since it contains derivative, in fact, it has almost diagonal but not diagonal element between the value of the function of x and the function at neighboring point of x. So in fact, you can represent the derivative by the derivative of the delta function. You can write, this is a bit special, but in the same way that you can write a function f of x as integral over dy of delta of x minus y, f of y, this is a kernel of an operator. So it depends, a function which depends on x and y, but it's just some kind of distribution which is only non-zero when x equal y. So in some sense, it's a diagonal matrix. You can write f prime of x as integral of dy delta prime of x minus y f of y with a minus, I think. No, that's okay because it's x minus y. So you integrate by part and you get delta times f prime of y. This is the kernel of d over dx. And it's a delta function. It's a derivative of a delta function. So it's something that it's a distribution localized at x equal y, but it's not diagonal because there is a, you can define it by a limit of f of x minus f of y divided by x minus y, letting the limit. So it's non-local. It's almost local. So that's exactly the same thing here. I've been a bit sketchy, but.
When you take the determinant, it's still like a determinant with respect to both the gauge and the space-time indices.
No, it's a determinant. So you have an operator that acts on, which depends on the gauge field, on the whole gauge field configuration. It's a differential operator, which contains, depends on the value of the gauge field at a given point, and but of derivatives. And you apply this differential operator on a function of x, and you obtain another function of x, well, with A indices. And but it depends on the derivative. So it has a non-trivial functional determinant, because it contains derivative. Okay. Okay, I'm a bit, okay, I think I will stop there. I've been a bit fast because I wanted you to get the just the idea in one lecture of why it's natural to consider the determinant of this functional derivative with respect to gauge transformation of the gauge fixing condition. It would have been too much time in one lecture to get the complete calculation, but all the details are, precise details are contained in the lecture notes. But that's the basic idea. And I'll stop here today. So next lecture, I'm going to present you the second step of this representation in terms of Fadeyev-Popov determinant, which is a great idea of Fadeyev and Popov, which is to represent this determinant of this prime, this operator f prime, which depends on the gauge configuration, which is a differential operator, as a harmonic path integral. We have seen in the lecture of quantization of fermions that determinant can be written as exponential of a fermionic integral of exponential of Gaussian, of quadratic form involving anti-commuting numbers, elements of a Grassmann algebra. Well, this can be applied for this object. It's just an application of the formula. But then the anti-commuting variables will be the famous ghosts and anti-ghost fields, which are fermions. And since this is a differential operator which acts on matrix, you know, on elements of function which are functioned in the Lie algebra, in the adjoint representation, in fact, each ghost carries a quantum number. So I will just write the ghost that you can use to it. You have a ghost which is called, which is denoted PA of X. You have an anti-ghost field, which is called C bar A of X. So that depends on space-time. And they carry a quantum number of the gauge group in the adjoint representation. So they carry the same charge than the gauge field. And, but they are fermionic field.
So that's a fermion of the spin one.
That's a fermion with spin zero. It's fermions because they anti-commute. So they are fermions.
So it's violated statistic theory.
Of course. They are spin one because they carry they carry spin zero. I'm sorry. So they carry spin zero because they have no mu. If they were carrying a Dirac in this index, they would have spin one half. If they were carrying a new index, they would have spin one, but they have no mu. Because that's because the gauge fixing condition doesn't depend on mu. That's because the Lorentz, the Landau gauge is just a Lorentz invariant. So it's spin zero. So indeed, they violate the spin statistic theorem. But the spin statistic theorem, I don't know if you have seen them, it's a bit of a mathematical theorem, but it's a real theorem under assumption for local quantum physics. Spin statistics requires two things, basically. It requires unitarity and Lorentz invariance. Okay, plus some technical condition. So this is Lorentz invariance. But so they violate unitarity. But if you don't have this term, if you just apply naively a gauge fixing, either in U1 theory or in S1 theory, you get negative norm states. Because you have seen, I think, in QFT2, the quantization of QFD, that if you are not careful, you have states with what's called longitudinal polarization. So the A mu is oriented in the direction of the momentum of the photon. And these states are very problematic. So they violate unitarity, but they are there to compensate the violation of unitarity that appears if you naively quantize the theory by just imposing, without being careful, a gauge condition. Because in that case, you are not taking the correct measure, which is consistent with gauge invariance on the gauge size that you have chosen by your gauge fixing condition. So I'm going to explain a bit that tomorrow. Well, not tomorrow, but on Tuesday, on Thursday. And I'm going to explain, in fact, that one of the reasons for this kind of miracles, or just proof of consistency of the theory, is a symmetry which mixes the ghost and anti-ghost field with the gauge field, which is called the Becky, Rouet, Stora, and Tuitlin symmetry. Which is a symmetry which remains when you fix the gauge. If you fix the gauge, in fact, of course, the gauge invariance has disappeared, but it has been transmuted into a very interesting symmetry, which is not local. It's non-local. It's a rigid, so it's not. It's a symmetry as symmetry when you make a global rotation on field. So it's a rigid symmetry. But it's a super symmetry because it mixes A mu with the gauge field. Okay, so that's what I'm going to to discuss in the next lecture, and we'll also a bit discuss the what are the correlation, what are the perturbative rules once you have this new term. Okay. Thank you. And well, if you feel that I've been too sketchy, because I've been very sketchy here, ask me questions. And now I'm here. I have an office. It's just in front of Debbie. And so I will maybe not be there always, but we can discuss if you like, or send me a mail. And well, all the details are in the lecture notes that I'm going to. Well, I'm going to update a bit, basically the lectures that you have in already, but I'm updating them a bit. Okay, thank you. Thank you. Well, thank you. Yeah.
I didn't trust you that unitarity is going to be recovered once we fix the physical states.
Yes.
But aren't you also breaking locality? Because I can just...
No.
In a very sketchy way, I can just take this here. What do I have?
Yes.
I can write this as... So assume that this is a million, I transmit the determinant with the law as the trace, and this is just over, this is just an integral or trace of x squared plus minus, I don't know.
No, I see what you mean. Yes. Okay. Yeah. No, I see. Well, you break locality if you express this uniquely as a functional of A. But the point is that basically I'm going determinant of a prime, you are writing as a functional integral over those field of exponential minus C bar. Well, this F prime operator, that's that's in this case, that is just d mu times d mu, which depend on A of C. It's a different operator, depends on A. And you have to add the gauge fixing term, but I will not discuss that at that time here. So you see that in terms of the A, the C bar and the C's, this is a local term. It's a local action.
Yes.
So in terms of the C's and the C bar, it's local.
But I can just integrate them out.
Sure. If you integrate them out,
then I will get some
output. Yeah, of course. If you basically, in fact, that we have that you have a propagator for the C bar. They propagate like